Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Moto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made, because that's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
There is a big trial that is about to get underway. We've been talking about it for roughly 3 years now, the Corey Richens murder trial. If all holds out, here we are. Jury has been seated. February 23rd in Summit County, nearly 4 years after Eric Richens was found dead from a fentanyl overdose. But heading into opening statements, the defense has landed some real pre-trial blows, recanting drug source witness intimidation allegations against the lead detective, excluded experts, and severed financial charges. Defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis is with us to help us break all this down. Eric, welcome. The man prosecutors say supplied the fentanyl, Robert Crozer. He's the big one for the defense here. He has signed a sworn an affidavit saying he sold oxy, not fentanyl, to the housekeeper, Carmen Lauber. He says he was detoxing and out of it during his 2023 police interview, and the pills were never recovered or tested. As a former prosecutor, I gotta ask you, how dangerous is it for the state when the alleged murder weapon, the pills, was never forensically confirmed, and the one person in the supply chain who knew the pills, what they were, now says that that's not true?
You know, Tony, I think it's a real significant problem. Look, the jury's going to want to see substantiation of these allegations. You know, they're saying it was fentanyl. Okay, well, where is the fentanyl? Was it ever found in her house? Did they ever get some sample to test? My understanding is no. And so now not only do we have the person who says it was fentanyl saying it's not fentanyl anymore, but you don't really have any sort of toxicology or forensic analysis in terms of that substance and connecting it to Corey Richens. And so that's kind of the linchpin of this case, is the fentanyl piece. And that appears on very shaky ground right now.
How does that work when somebody says, well, I did something bad, but it wasn't the bad thing that you're saying I did? How does that work?
So certainly that source has some credibility issues, it appears. And the jury is going to have to evaluate that. You know, they're going to say, hey, was he lying to police about the fentanyl, or is he lying now saying it's oxy when it was really fentanyl? How much faith can we really place in this person's testimony? And that's why we have jurors to determine that credibility.
Can all of this just be true? And simply the answer to the question is, a lot of the street oxy has fentanyl in it. And ta-da! You thought you knew you weren't selling fentanyl. You sold Oxy, and the woman who bought it from you, the housekeeper, also knew it was Oxy. Maybe she told Corey it was fentanyl. Maybe Corey thought it was fentanyl. Maybe at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter what everybody was saying to each other on the name of the street drug they were buying, because at the end of the day, no matter what they called it, there was still fentanyl in it.
Mm-hmm.
Very well could be, but if I'm defense, I'm objecting to that kind of information coming in that a lot of street oxy contains fentanyl. What's the source for that? Did the prosecution have an expert who's going to get up there and say that? And they tested, 100 samples and, 30 of them came back with fentanyl. I'm not sure they have that evidence to back it up. And so I think that could fall under speculation, and the judge may preclude such an inference that a normal person might draw, but in the court of law, things are a little more stringent.
True. I mean, obviously there's that, but the fact that this drug itself that went from person to person to person, there's nothing in here that's saying I didn't sell it. It's just saying it wasn't fentanyl that I sold. It was Oxy I was selling. That I think is the difference, because it's not completely eliminating this chain of custody of this drug. It's just saying, oh, we got the name wrong somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. And one question that also arises is how does the source know exactly what that substance was? Are they a chemist? Are they a doctor? No.
Exactly.
There could be a lot of different ideas about what this source thought this substance was, and perhaps the jury will hear about those things.
Well, and legitimate pharmacies can make mistakes. What do you think a drug dealer could do?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, and also, let's just talk about credibility here. I mean, this is something that the Richens defense is certainly grasping onto with both hands and feet, and probably putting their chin over the bar too, because this is really good stuff. But at the same point, it's like one of the only lifelines that are out there for them. So they're really going to make this into a big thing. The credibility of the guy is shit. I mean, changing the story, I was strung out, so I really don't know what I was saying at the time. This is not a very credible witness, period, honestly, for either side. The defense really needs this to be a credible witness. For the prosecution, does not have the same weight.
Yeah, I generally agree. And, it's going to be, I'll be interested to see how this person presents to the jury, what they look like, what their demeanor's like, as they're describing these previous discrepancies and inconsistent statements. Are they going to try to explain them away? That's going to be difficult. But as defense has to plant a seed of doubt. They don't need to necessarily prove this confidential informant was telling the truth 100% about everything. They just need to get the jurors to start, scratching their head and saying, wait a sec, this seems bizarre. And does that translate into reasonable doubt? It could be a big component of it.
Just weeks before jury selection here, actually, weeks before jury selection, we're not just saying weeks before jury selection took place, defense attorneys released text messages showing lead detective Jeff O'Driscoll allegedly threatening a witness with arrest and bringing, and this is where I think it really kind of goes off the rails, because it's one thing you sometimes do have to threaten people with arrest to compel them to show up. But then you get to verbiage of a catch pole for your dog.
Yikes.
In there. I mean, candor, hold it back. Just, take a beat before you add that sentence to the email. If she didn't cooperate with the trial prep, a second witness said investigator Travis Hooper warned their immunity could be revoked if they didn't meet with prosecutors again. Talk about this a little bit. Is this something that's being blown into something bigger than it is, or is this starting to border into witness intimidation? I've heard that thrown around. What's your take?
You know, the purported threats to revoke immunity if the person doesn't cooperate, that's actually pretty standard. That's not terribly controversial, in my opinion. However, the statements from the lead detective about, you know, getting some device to detain the dog if you don't help out, the optics of that are a nightmare. And it makes this guy look like a villain. And that reflects on the prosecution, who are supposed to be the good guys. They're supposed to be in there, you know, with the white hats, trying to get to the truth and find justice. And you have this lead detective threatening to take somebody's dog, shows he has a real interest, at least a personal interest, in the outcome of this case. And how, and could that have shaped other parts of the investigation? Defense will certainly bring that up.
You know, what it brought up in my head was, I'll get you and your little dog too. You know, it was just this, what, excuse me, who are you? Are you a professional or are you the freaking Wicked Witch? You know, I mean, that's not how you act in the legal system, is it?
No, I mean, that sort of adds this kind of nefarious, ominous tone to that side of things, which could be problematic.
Yeah, I mean, it optics are everything, whether it's legal or not, or just, you know, overstepping, or they felt for some reason. I mean, we the context is everything, and we don't know the context of their communications. Who knows what kind of, if or if there was or not some sort of adversarial communication going on. Who knows if there, I don't know. You could completely speculate on why that may have been made, whether it's just out of spite or maybe someone threatened to sick their dog on them. So it may make logical sense to say, and the dog poll is coming too. You know, there might be more to that, but without knowing it, it's hard to really speculate. Judge Marzik excluded the prosecution's domestic violence expert. Let's talk about this, because one of the levers that the Richens campaign defense wanted to pull here was saying that Eric had been abusive in the relationship. That Corey had a video as well. The video's never surfaced. There's no images that's ever surfaced. It's only been Corey's words, and there's been no one to back it up. There's been no witnesses that say, yes, I witnessed anything physically violent. That's what she was talking about physical violence here. They were going to try and use it as though it's a pathway to violence, some sort of framework there. When you don't have any sort of evidence in something like this, yet you want to bring it up. I know it's been excluded, but is that the right move? Is that the common move to do in something like this when you really just can't back it up?
You know, both sides are limited in terms of the experts they can proffer to a jury, and they're limited by what the evidence is. There has to be this nexus between the experts' opinions and the substantial evidence in the case. And it sounds like the judge ultimately determined, hey, this is a fine theory, but it's not significantly connected to this case in a demonstrable evidentiary way. And so it sounds like that was probably the right ruling. You know, the judge doesn't want the jury to confuse issues or develop some kind of bias or prejudice based on an expert whose opinions may not be particularly pertinent to the evidence the jury is deciding.
And it's a hot button issue. I know a lot of people I've seen comments on this where, and I think it goes through everybody's prism too. Anyone who's been through physical violence or abuse are going to naturally be more sensitive to this without a doubt because you've experienced it. And then when someone makes the claim, you know, you do want to believe them, but the reality is you can't believe it every time. You can. This is a woman who's being accused of murdering him. So of course, if you can get some sort of sympathy or empathy from a jury, you're going to make that claim. The shitty part about it is that even if it is true, it's a very hard one to prove if there is no evidence of it. And I guess some would say the way that she seems to, you know, claims to have documented this or made claims that it was documented and then never backed that up, never came back with the receipts that she claimed she had. What does that tell you about the legitimacy of the claim in general? If you're gonna walk out there and say, I can prove it with a picture, and then you don't have the picture, I mean, obviously the jury's not gonna hear that part, but all of us on the outside did.
Well, yeah, and you know, if Corey Richens testifies, which is a huge if, the prosecution can try to bring up prior acts of dishonesty. Yeah. So is coming forward and saying, hey, I have this evidence of this horrible wrongful conduct on behalf of this dead guy, and it's going to make me look good, and I'll show you guys, and then she can't show anything. Is that an act of dishonesty? Is that something that the jury might be able to consider in deciding her credibility? If she testifies, I think that's potentially on the table.
No. What's about the 26 separate financial crime charges? Let's talk about that for a second. This is a win for the defense, and we're focusing on the defense right now. They wanted to bring up those charges, the financial crimes, mortgage fraud, money laundering, bad checks into the murder trial to prove motive. Very similar to the Alec Murdaugh trial, where, see, this is all part of the story. Maybe not quite, you know, directly, but it's part of the context of the story. And it would prove motive as to why she maybe did this to reap the rewards of the insurance money and then to be in control of all of the money. Judge Marzik denied both of those requests and blocked evidence from those severed charges. How does the defense exploit that ruling to keep the jury focused strictly on whether the state can prove Corey poisoned Eric?
You know, I think it's a huge win for the defense, because we saw the Alec Murdaugh trial, like you mentioned, there were just this list of all of these alleged financial crimes, and it made him look like a complete swindler and a scam artist and someone who can't possibly be believed. Corey Richens is not going to have to contend with that same thing at her trial. And so as defense, you know, you really want to limit and narrow the focus to the evidence or absence of evidence, including the absence of important toxicology and substance analysis. And so I think that it only helps the defense here. I think that was a big ruling.
I want to ask you this, and I asked Bob Mata this the other day, because I think this could be a really interesting element to the story as a piece of evidence if it were to be admitted, and I don't know why it hasn't been. He's not cremated. He's still alive. The hair follicles still exist somewhere in a grave, and probably already samples sitting somewhere in an autopsy folder.
Or a hairbrush.
What's that?
Or a hairbrush.
Well, I mean, it's been a couple of years, but somewhere they're in existence is the point being. Hair would show a lot. Hair would answer a big question of whether Eric was this active fentanyl drug user or not. I know Corey's the defense is from what we can glean, kind of pointing to some direction of, see, Eric, you know, he used illicit drugs from time to time. And now they want to try and bring up evidence from high school. I don't know that that's getting in. But high school evidence would mean nothing if those hair follicles showed a pattern of use. It's like the rings of a tree. It would show if he had been an active user of fentanyl for any period of time, or if it was just a spike at the end, or like never really for that matter. This could be a huge boon to the defense of Corey Richens. It could show a pattern of use where, well, look, it's very easy to overdose on this shit, and you ran out of luck, buddy. It can show he doesn't do it at all, and this is a very huge deviation in behavior. It's a dice roll that I don't know either side wants to throw down the table. What's your thoughts?
You know, if I'm defense, oftentimes in these investigations, I'm a former prosecutor too, so from that side, you know, you don't know exactly what analyses are going to be super pertinent to defenses, because you don't know the defenses yet.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the prosecution could have done this analysis early on. If I'm defense, I'm saying, hey, are you kidding me? This would perhaps answer the question as to whether this was an accidental overdose or something more nefarious. And the government didn't even bother to do a standard test that you know, thousands of probation officers do all the time across the country. Why didn't they do that? That just shows an absence of evidence and a shoddy forensic investigation. And that's sort of the horse I'm riding if I'm defense.
Nobody knows quite what the answer would be to that. I mean, if it's out there, then the answer is out there already. But I've heard nothing of this, and maybe it'll come up in court. But without really truly knowing, exactly how this is going to play out. I don't know. I mean, for the argument of truth and odds and reality, this is something that should be known. But when you're, you know, picking a side of I want this or that to happen, it becomes a dice roll.
It does. And I think that those unknowns often inure to the benefit of defense. When I was a prosecutor, you know, I would try to dot all of the I's, cross all of the T's, think about, hey, what is defense going to argue? And how can I sort of ratchet this up and preempt that kind of a thing by additional investigation, by additional experts, that kind of thing? So when you have an unknown, that can often look suspiciously similar to reasonable doubt. And when you get to the trial phase, if the jury is left with all of these questions, that can be consistent with reasonable doubt.
Yeah, it's a question. I saw somebody said it only stays in 90 days. It does not. It stays in for much longer than that. I actually did research on this the other night because it was like, this, why, what is this? This seems like an interesting angle for this this case that could answer a lot of questions. Prosecutors have Corey's post-death Google search history, searches that include what is considered a lethal dose of fentanyl. That could be argued away as, you know, you're curious what happened here. But then we get to luxury prisons for the rich in America. How long does life insurance companies take to pay? Can delete text messages be retrieved? Can cops force you to lie to a lie detector test? And when does FBI get involved in a case? So it goes from kind of like, I'm curious about what happened to my hubby, to don't take me away. Her former attorney argued that those searches were just Corey reacting to the investigation, not evidence of guilt. If you're the defense, how do you neutralize that search history in front of a jury? Because it's not very,
Can you?
Can you? Other than saying, everybody, la, 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 la.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that one doesn't work so well. But if there were like one or two or three of those searches, it would be a lot more manageable because the jury's going to be instructed that they can view all the evidence in its totality. You don't have to view in isolation one search and say, oh, that could have been explainable. But what about three? What about four? What about five? And so if you're you do kind of say, hey, she's reacting to the investigation. You know, you haven't had your spouse die before. You don't know what you might search. You might be frantic and you might be in a chaotic situation. You might not be in the right state of mind. So there are arguments that can be made, but there are certainly counter arguments to this.
Yeah.
Well, and how do you justify her having the party? And forgive me, I don't have the actual date, but it was very shortly after his death that she had the party. Is that right? How do you justify doing that?
Celebration of life.
But it wasn't. No. It had to do with the flipping of the house or the selling of the house.
Celebration of life, the life of a bank account where the husband's not going to say, you can't keep swindling money out of me. Right. It's celebration of life, dot, dot, dot. And then parentheses on a very, like, really low, small font on the big old vinyl poster that they put up outside of the house, you know. Your thoughts in the comment section, everybody, on the defense of Corey Richens and what we're looking at going into this trial. We're, of course, going to be covering it here for you every single day. Let us know in Substack and on YouTube. The defense has made noise, but the prosecution still has a mountain of evidence for 5 weeks of trial, an alleged prior poisoning attempt, a direct witness who says Corey personally requested fentanyl, forged documents, damning digital evidence, and a financial timeline prosecutors say points to one conclusion. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, is with us to help break down the state's strongest arguments and what it takes to prove murder beyond a reasonable doubt. Eric, let's get into the prosecution of this. The attempted murder charges from Valentine's Day. That's the original attempt back in 2022. Loving thing to do. The allegation is that Corey laced Eric's favorite sandwich. She winning, I don't know, I really would love to know what the sandwich was, but that's not listed here. Maybe it's in the affidavit somewhere. But laced his favorite sandwich with fentanyl, left it in his vehicle. Then he goes to get it from work and eats it, breaks out in hives, loses consciousness like you do after eating your favorite sandwich. Two friends say Eric called them saying his wife tried to poison him. It's kind of weird that's the first thing that's come into this guy's mind. His sister told authorities he believed Corey had spiked his drink years earlier in Greece, so he's living in paranoia, and told family if anything happened to him, she was to blame. A new life insurance policy went into effect February 4th, 10 days before that Valentine's Day attempt. If the jury hears all of that in that order, how does that reshape the case?
You know, I think it's going to be pivotal whether the jury believes that Corey Richens did actually engage in this prior poisoning, because it obviously goes to her mental state. It shows a conscious objective. It shows planning over time. It shows that she had this outcome she was trying to get at. She failed the first time, but she didn't fail this subsequent time. And certainly if the jury believes it, that could tip the scales incredibly. You know, we're not just talking about one poisoning, but multiple poisonings over time. Now, one thing is, I'm not sure that Eric Richens, that all of his statements regarding that prior poisoning to other folks will be admitted into evidence. So it might be a little bit more difficult to get the jury to fully accept.
Despite Crozer's recantation, prosecutors still have Carmen Lauber. That's because there's a couple cogs in this wheel that get all the way to Eric. You got Eric over here who consumed the fentanyl. You got Corey who's alleged to have given it to him. Then you got Carmen Lauber who procured it from Crozer. So it's several people. And this is an interesting thing that I think is going to get brought up, especially too when we're talking about the semantics of the name, of what exactly he thought he was selling or what he was selling or not selling, depending on how strung out he was at the time. The housekeeper still says Corey directly asked her to buy fentanyl twice in early 2022, deliver the pills to the property. And after Valentine's Day attempt, Corey asked for something stronger. And so this testimony is there. Take Crozer out of the situation. You got the backup, the one that's even closer, the one that's even more impactful, specifically saying Corey asked for, quote, the Michael Jackson stuff, which is not fentanyl. That's propofol.
Yeah.
Totally different drug. But it also shows an utter confusion and lack of understanding of what she's even asking for. Is Lauber's firsthand account of Corey's direct request more powerful than any supply chain evidence? And how does the prosecution protect her from the stand?
You know, I think if the jury accepts the housekeeper's testimony about Corey's request for these drugs, that's going to be a huge problem for the defense. And, you know, as prosecution, you're saying to the jury, hey, we don't pick our witnesses. We didn't choose these folks. These folks happen to be caught up in this. But the housekeeper, you know, if they can establish that the housekeeper has no significant bias against Corey Richens, that she has no significant interest in the outcome of the case, which that'll be questioned. But if they can, and especially too, how the housekeeper presents on the stand, just person to person, if she's believable and if she's straightforward and if she, you know, owns any missteps she may have made or something like that, but still stands firm on her previous testimony, that could be the nail in the coffin for Corey.
Yeah.
There's a lot of nails. There's a lot of nails and there's a lot of hammers heading this way right now. Like the walk the dog letter, that's another one. It was found in Corey's jail cell, described by prosecutors as outlining a false testimony for her mother and brother. The judge partially granted its admission. Separately, prosecutors have five pages from an orange notebook they call Corey's firsthand account of the day Eric died, with details that allegedly conflict with other evidence. How does a prosecutor use the defendant's own writings to build premeditation when one document allegedly coaches witnesses and another contradicts the physical evidence itself?
Yeah, you know, as a prosecutor, one thing I would encourage the jury to do, like I said, is view things in their totality, view them as a whole. You know, the defense might have proposed alternative explanations for this internet search or for, you know, the insurance policy or something. But when you look at this as a whole, you ask the jury to use their common sense and you say, hey, does this look like a person who is innocent? Are these the acts that an innocent person would take? All of these, you know, internet searches about what prison might I be going to and stuff like that. And so I think you sort of encourage the jury to use their common sense in evaluating all of this and not be distracted by the alternative, innocent, proposed explanations by defense.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Tony.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I don't want to change off of the walk the dog letter, but what also pops into my head is how do you justify her writing this book as well? And we can talk about the book later if you want to stay on the walk the dog. But to me, this book this is a glaring thing against her, I think.
Are you talking about the children's book?
Yeah. The children's book about, you know, how to grieve, you know, your dad, you know, after he's gone. Is that a cathartic thing? Is that how you present that to a jury? Or is this like, hey, now she's even trying to profit off of the death? How do you frame this?
You know, that's the thing. If you're the prosecutor, you're saying, hey, this person tried to poison their husband not once, but twice, took out this insurance policy. And then afterwards, after what would be a horrible tragedy to most, she sought to make some bucks off of the acts she committed. You know, what a low-life scoundrel. You can't say that last part, but you can intimate it. If you're in prosecution, that's sort of how you're framing it. If you're defense, you're saying, hey, this was a person in mourning who was trying to be cathartic and explain a circumstance in her life that she thought could help others.
Which could be very powerful, because I'm going to guess the big heartstring tug that the defense is going to use in this, and if you're not planning for this already, you're welcome, is going to be the kids. Yep. It's going to be, and look, she's a loving mother. She's trying to find a way to help her kids deal and grieve and work their way through this. And then their mother was ripped away from them.
Yep.
Don't keep this loving mother who wrote a book about their father away from them any longer.
Right, exactly. And that's, and I've seen that argument. You got to kind of be delicate in terms of how you make it, because the judge is going to say, hey, you can't just play upon the sympathies of the jury, but you could say, hey, she wrote a book and she has these kids and the dad is dead. And depending on the outcome of this trial, these kids might be suffering more, and you know, you kind of have to dance around it, but certainly a compelling narrative, especially if the jury's on the fence and reasonable doubt, that can tip the scales by saying, I'm not sure, but I'm going to err on the side of these kids having a mom.
And then you go back to, she just needs to get back home. These kids are starving for more of their mother's peanut butter and fentanyl sandwiches. And it's like, whoa. No, she should not go back at this point. But I don't know. It could be in the Corey Richens recipe book. There's an idea for a cookbook. Corey Richens recipes for prison. Tony. Peanut butter and fentanyl.
Dear.
Yeah. A little drink section, a little, you know, snacks, appetizers, little amuse-bouche. It'll be delicious. Handwriting expert Matt Throckman was the one prosecution expert the judge allowed without restriction. He's expected to testify about whether signatures on insurance and financial documents were actually Eric's. If the prosecution demonstrates Corey forged her husband's signature on policies designed to pay her millions upon his death, does that single piece of evidence kind of merge fraud and murder motive into one narrative that the jury just can't really unsee?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it would certainly be condemning for Corey Richens, because, you know, looking to profit off of this and engaging in misleading and deceptive conduct. If you're the prosecutor, you're saying, hey, that's kind of par for the course for Corey Richens. She's done that in other parts of the trial. And the fact that she did it on these documents allegedly just makes it more likely that she has been misleading and deceptive and trying to cover this up in other instances. And so you kind of use it as a broad application to the other potential explanations that Corey Richens has given. So, the handwriting expert could be big. We'll have to see if the jury accepts.
What version of Corey Richens do you think we see in court coming up on Monday here? Like physically, what how is she going to present? Because that's a big thing. In every one of these cases, there is going to be some psychology behind that. What version would you advise Corey Richens to present to a jury? How should she be looking, as silly as it is, but it makes an impact?
You know, I think if your defense and you believe that your client is not guilty, a favorable presentation would be to the point where she is distraught and she's overwhelmed. You know, I'm not saying crying during court all the time or something, but emotional and clearly in emotional distress. On top of that, I think that it would behoove her to show at least some indignation, saying, hey, not only did I lose my husband and my family, but now they're trying to pile on this wrongful murder charge. It's wrong. I'm wronged here. And it's a delicate balance. You can't come out and you know, try to act like the hero in all of this. But I think a balance between emotional distress and indignation could play well to a jury.
Going to be fascinating to see where this goes. Your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube or Substack, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, is what you search on either platform to find us. The links are also in the descriptions. Let's go on to another case that is making a lot of headlines. Colin Gray is now sitting in a Georgia courtroom facing 29 counts, including second-degree murder, because prosecutors say he handed his mentally deteriorating 14-year-old son an AR-style rifle as a Christmas present after what the state describes as a years-long parade of warning signs he allegedly refused to act on. You know, like making collages on your wall of other school shooters. You know, like one may have posters up of, I don't know, this age, here's how bad I am.
Here comes an 80s reference, everybody.
I mean, I know what would be back in the day would be like for people would be everything from like Britney Spears to Backstreet Boys to NSYNC to Destiny's Child. That would be, you know, the 90s. I don't know what it would be today. Whoever, whatever that would be. Nobody in their right mind was putting up tributes to school shooters unless you yourself, you were a school shooter. This is the second major trial in the U.S. testing whether parents can be held criminally responsible when their children carry out school shootings. And the prosecution's case against Colin Gray may be even more damning than what we saw with the Crumbleys in Michigan. Former prosecutor Eric Faddis is here to break down every element of the state's case, dismantle the defense's strategy, and explain why the evidence trail that Colin Gray allegedly left behind could actually bury him. Eric, prosecutors have opened by saying this isn't about holding parents accountable for what their kids do. It's about what Colin Gray specifically did. It's not an across-the-board damnation for every parent that discovers they have a monster child that did something. The state alleges he was warned by the FBI, by law enforcement, by child welfare officials that his son was a potential threat. And his response was to buy him an Sig Sauer AR-15 style M400 for Christmas. From the prosecutor's perspective, how do you even begin to defend that sort of sequence of events?
You know, I think you really highlight in detail all of the red flags, the numerous indications that the prosecution says Colin Gray had about how dangerous his son was and what his son was capable of. And I think you really go in painstaking detail. And I've even, in closing arguments, I've seen someone, they had not a pen cushion, but something into which you can put these little pointed red flags. And they put them there and they compiled something like 25 red flags. Yeah. And this was a different case. But I'm just saying that approach to showing, hey, it wasn't one red flag. It wasn't two things. It was a series of events over a long period of time. And any reasonable person should have seen the writing on the wall.
This is going to change everything for parenting. You know, at some point, parents are going to be responsible for everything that their kids do. And some kids are not controllable. So this just puts us into such a gray area. This controllable. You don't hand your child, you know, a mentally deteriorating child, an AR-style weapon or a weapon in general. But what happens if your kid supplies alcohol that you gave to your kid and then somebody goes and drives drunk? I mean, it starts this cascade of events, doesn't it?
I think there's a very real concern about that. You know, in America, we have this school shooting problem, and it's horrendous, and it's not getting much better. And so I think that the legal system is reaching for options that it might have that it thinks might act as a deterrent. We saw the crumbliest parents being prosecuted in Michigan. Now we have Colin Gray. But there's certainly a risk as to how far can that go and where does sort of fairness end and punitive measures take over, and is that really what we want?
Let's walk through the warning signs the prosecution laid out, because the timeline is staggering. In 2021, Colt allegedly searched How to Kill Your Dad on a school computer, you know, like you do. In May of 23, according to prosecutors, the FBI flagged online threats tied to Colt about a school shooting then. So the threats were coming, and investigators told Colin to restrict gun access. 7 months later, he allegedly gives his son a rifle for Christmas with accessories. Yeah, because you can't just have the gun. You got to get all the add-ons. Then in August of 24, prosecutors say Colt texts his father, "Whenever something happens, just know the blood is on your hands." This is the person that is off the rails already, telling someone, "I'm off the rails and you're giving me the weaponry to make life even worse." Now, obviously, he does have his own set of choices to make, but he's screaming at you that I'm not capable of making rational choices, basically. Separately, asks him to buy 150 rounds of ammo. So it's your responsibility. Give me some bullets. Dad does it. I mean, as someone who's prosecuted cases, how many of these red flags would you need before a reasonable person acts? And how many did Colin Gray allegedly blow past here? It's insane.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly some indications that most parents would look at and say, oh, gosh, not only is this concerning, not only should we consider some intervention, but we also got to consider some protective measures, like what was allegedly recommended, that the child be restrained from any firearms. You don't then go get the kid a firearm. Like, you know, I think that those red flags are certainly mounting in this case, and that's what the prosecution's going to use to show, hey, this dad disregarded a substantial and unjustifiable risk that this would happen. He provided the child with the opportunity to carry this out and the mechanism by which the child did so. And those are certainly critical elements.
The defense is arguing that Colin led a double life and hid his intentions from his father. It was all behind the curtain, which is bullshit. The hidden phone shows, the notes on the hidden phone show he was planning the attack for February 25 to coincide with the Parkland anniversary. And Colin had no way of knowing. Okay, so maybe there's one little element you didn't have. But prosecutors revealed that Colt allegedly had a shrine to Nicholas Cruz in his bedroom, and Colt's mother was allegedly aware of his attempts to contact the Parkland shooter in prison, even sent him money, and the defense itself argues she never warned Colin. So, the signs are there. Maybe he didn't have the exact date. The kid's saying, it's going to be your fault when I do it. Can I have some money for bullets, Dad? I mean, so how does the defense simultaneously say Colin didn't know while the evidence shows the obsession was visible inside the home he controlled?
You know, all fair points. I think the defense is going to argue that, hey, parenting is hard, and just parenting a non-troubled child is hard.
Right? I just said that. No shit.
And when you have a child who is troubled, and you're a parent, like, what exactly are your options? You can't just lock the child in his room forever. I think the defense is probably going to say there are some things the dad did do to try to nurture and protect us.
He didn't have to keep the kid locked. He just didn't have to buy him guns and bullets and accessories. He could have kept the door unlocked. He could have just been like, I'm not feeding the machine. I'm not feeding this little monster over here. But instead, he's like, what's the worst possible shit I can put into this machine? Let me give that to him. For some reason, the machinery working in the mind of Colin Gray, while the fire is already burning strong and taking over the brain of his son, clearly, he decides, you know what? Let's get some more gasoline and pour that on. Is there any other accelerants we can find nearby? Let's do like everything other than water. Let's put on this. And then let's throw a couple M80s and dynamite in there, you know, just for good fucking measure. I mean, that's exactly what he did. And then to be like, I don't know, parenting's hard. No, I think like breathing and living might actually be hard for you because your mind seems to work in this bizarro path that's the opposite of reality.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's the last thing you would want to do is give a volatile, unstable, potentially violent child a gun.
Yeah.
So when they're apparently worshiping a prior school shooter, you know, I think this is going to be these trucks are going to be a message to parents like, hey, you don't have to be perfect. You might not even have to be good under the law, but you can't be complicit in a horribly violent act and provide the instrument that your child uses to do that. I think that's really the message the prosecution is trying to send.
And there's a difference here between the Crumbleys in this case. And I think that's it's a big distinction because people are like, well, it's another one where the parents are being charged. Yes, but this is different. And this is why it matters, because this is another precedent setting case. The Crumbleys set it in one lane. This is another lane because it's a different charge that's going on here. So we have the Crumbleys, that one in Michigan, where both parents, they were convicted of involuntary manslaughter and both sentenced to 10 to 15 years. Colin Gray is facing second degree murder charges, not manslaughter, which is a big difference. The legal theory here is that providing the weapon constitutes cruelty to children. And under Georgia law, causing a child's death through cruelty to children qualifies as second degree murder. So is this a stronger or weaker legal framework than what was used against the Crumbleys? And does the charge elevation change the calculus for the jury at the end of the day?
You know, I was reading the Georgia statute before we went on the air today, and I think that charge is weaker. I'm not sure that, you know, there might be kind of a logical disconnect between a firearm and cruelty to children. You're not, you know, menacing the child with the firearm. You're not pistol whipping the child. You're not shooting the child. You're providing a child with something. While it might be irresponsible, is that the same thing as cruelty? And then the second piece is, can they prove the causation element? You know, they're going to have to prove that the dad was a substantial factor in causing the deaths of these four people in this school shooting. And defense is going to say, hey, wait a sec, I'll tell you the main causes. And it's this troubled kiddo who pulled the trigger.
Wow. Can
you show causation by inaction? Because you have action here, but you also have inaction at the same time. You have the action of buying the weapons and arming your kid. And then you also have the inaction of not parenting, of not playing your role as a parent, of stopping any of this, stopping your kid from the posters of the school shooters when he's warning you he's going to go do this shit, that it's your fault. I mean, you have both going on. You have just pure enablement and then stand back and watch it burn is basically what went on here.
Yeah, usually you can actions and omissions or inaction can be a factual component of causation. You know, what did this person do? What did they not do? Now, typically just holding off and not taking action, that'd be a very weak causation argument. But here, like you said, you kind of have both supplying the firearm and then also not following up, you know, not intervening when they had knowledge that something really horrible could happen. You know, if something happens, there's going to be blood on your hands, dad. I think any dad would be like, whoa, what the hell do you mean? Like, we need to get a doctor involved. We need, I don't know, possibly the police, a mental health professional. And it seems like none of those actions were taken. Did that substantially contribute to what happened? Prosecution is definitely going to say it did.
So yeah. Is that why they haven't charged the mom? Because she didn't give the gun? That they're focusing mainly on this gun as being this huge facet of this case, and that's why mom has not been charged?
I think that that's a critical element. And whereas the mom kind of might be cast as an irresponsible parent who should have known more and should have done more, she did not take that overt step that really enmeshes the father in this subsequent tragedy that happened at the school.
Wow.
Colin Gray is facing up to 180 years if convicted on all 29 counts. 25 witnesses testified on day two alone, including roughly 20 juvenile students who described being shot, seeing blood, and fearing they would die, all while seeing or sitting literally feet away from the defendant. With this level of emotional testimony from child victims, combined with what the prosecution alleges as a mountain of prior warnings, what's your honest assessment here of where the trial is headed for Colin?
You know, I think that there's a reasonable likelihood of conviction. I think the defense is going to try to limit the heart-wrenching facts that are going to come forward, but the jury's going to be entitled to hear. Four people died. And the circumstances under which they died. Now, they're probably not going to be able to get into all the blood and guts and stuff like that. But certainly the jury's going to look at this. Four deaths. What was the source of that? What was the instrument that was used? From whom was that provided? And all of that points to Colin Gray.
Do you think this will change anything? Is this going to make anybody smarter? Is this going to make the parents out there, the Colin Grays of the world, that are so ignorant and so stupid that when they have a mentally ill child, they still get them the weapon because it's their right? I mean, I'm not against having weapons, so nobody take me that way. I'm saying I'm against mentally ill people, and I'm against adults arming their children that are mentally ill. But I think you probably have to be somewhat mentally ill yourself to think it okay to harm your mentally ill child. Is it going to change anything at the end of the day? Is it going to make the, well, I don't want to get in trouble? Is that going to change those folks, or are they already that far gone that, you know, they don't even know this is happening to begin with?
That's unclear, but what I'm hoping is that organizations like the NRA and organizations that really advocate and educate gun owners become to be more involved and sort of say, hey, look, for better or for worse, this is what the criminal justice system is doing when it comes to firearms and parents. This is what you need to know about the risks. This is what you need to know about ensuring that this doesn't happen and also, you know, protecting your own ass as a parent. And perhaps some of these sources like the NRA, you know, these potential parents would listen to them more than, you know, somebody talking on a news station or something. So I'm just wondering if sort of the gun lobby and the gun folks might become more involved and might put out some more warnings and some more education on stuff like this.
Something.
Anything
like an electric shock collar that you put on your arm, and when your child picks up the weapon, it buzzes you, and you're like, oh, bad, no, put gun down, bad. I don't know. I mean, because educating and informing and that, you know, it completely eludes a jackass like Colin Gray. So hopefully, I don't know, hopefully something. Very interesting to see this finally being prosecuted, and hopefully this will bring a lot more accountability to those that deserve it. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, as always, thank you for being here. We greatly appreciate it. Let's get your thoughts in the comment section, Substack, or on YouTube, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Just search that. The links are in the descriptions. We'd love to get your feedback on this and any of the stories that we're following for you right here. Until next time. For Eric, Stacy, and Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Moro Casino. American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps.
In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly.
Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.